The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Danny Cannell, Chip Patterson, Barton Simmons, and Tom Fernelli. It's your call for the best college football coverage from National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Barton Simmons, that's Tom Fernelli, that's Danny Cannell, I'm Chip Patterson. We got a loaded show for you today. There is a lot of news breaking all around college football. We've got college football players who are sticking up for their right to not only play, but their right to try and play under safe conditions and maintain health both on and off the field. And we've got Big Ten win totals. Right? Don't we?
Wait, are we under. I'm taking the under on every single one.
Are we not doing Big Ten win totals?
We should have just put our head down, not talked about anything else today, and just went about a Big Ten win total vibe like nothing else is happening.
I've thought about the just start an alternate universe series of podcasts where we go through and we're actually picking each week, throwing locks out, and just you know what? Trust tree, baby. It's just us here. We don't have to act like the games aren't being canceled or taken off the schedule.
Well, keep that option on the table because I have a feeling we might have to use it. So keep it on the back burner.
3 p.m. here on a Monday. Let's sort of run through some of the ups and downs of the weekend. At least where we stand right now is that the Big Ten is trending towards not playing college football in 2020, at least as a league decision. There has been some various reporting. I tend to think that everyone's trying to jump because they feel like they've read the tea leaves. And so everyone's taking every little bit or every little sourced information to get there. But we are starting to see a disconnect, especially as we sit here and record. And so I want to start at the Big Ten. The disconnect is between the university presidents, the conference commissioner, Kevin Warren, and then some of the head coaches, and then even the players within the Big Ten. Justin Fields, among the players that participated in a Zoom call on Sunday night, along with Chuba Hubbard from Oklahoma State, Najee Harris from Alabama, Penei Sewell from Oregon, Trevor Lawrence and Darian Rencher from Clemson. Who am I missing? I know that all Power 5 conferences were represented. I guess I got at least most of them right there. I think that, you know, there is in this revised set of expectations from the We Are United and We Want to Play movements, a very, very sharp focus on playing, but also guaranteeing eligibility, also guaranteeing some health and safety protocols all across the board. There are coaches who are trying to fight for their players, but again, a disconnect from what seems to be a growing trend towards the Big Ten moving towards not playing football in 2020. I think there is another piece of this, especially with Scott Frost's comments that we can get to in terms of what happens if a school wants to move forward. I've got some, at least somewhat specific thoughts on that. But for right now, is all of this momentum from coaches and from players, do you think that it's enough to allow either individual schools or the conference as a whole to be playing football in 2020?
No. No, if they would have started this like 5 months ago, maybe.
You think so?
But maybe. You had a better chance if you started 5 months ago than you do now. Now it's too late. We're trending towards, like you said, the Big Ten is likely, based on the tea leaves that we're reading from everybody, within the next 24 to 48 hours, the Big Ten is going to be announcing that it's canceling the season. There's reports that the Pac-12 is pretty much going to do it as soon as the Big Ten does, if not at the same time as a joint statement. And once that happens, it's only going to be a matter of time before the SEC, the Big 12, and the ACC do the same thing, no matter what they're posturing right now. No.
I mean, you're telling me you can't see a world.
If everybody else is doing it.
You can't see a world where the SEC is just double burden everybody and saying, we're playing.
No, like, because it's not going to be up to the coaches and the athletic directors. It's going to be up to the school presidents. It's going to be up to a whole lot of things that have absolutely nothing to do with any of the coaches or the players. They're not going to play once everybody else does it. Everybody's just kind of too scared to be the first to say so. But as soon as somebody else does and they have the excuse and they can just kind of follow along, the SEC, because of what you're getting at being like, you know, the thought that maybe they would stick out, that's the reason they'll never be the first to do it. Because they can't be the SEC. It would go completely against its brand to be like, no, we don't want to do it because, you know, they're too tough. They're too this, they're too that. As soon as the Big Ten does it and the Pac-12 does it, the SEC will say, okay, well, everybody else is doing it. We should do it too. It's the right thing to do.
I don't know. I'm kind of with Barton. Maybe it's just a hopeful optimism, which, you know, I know it's not a plan. I know it's not there. I feel like you may be underestimating the power of college football in the South, even with the school presidents, even with some of the liabilities. And I also think that maybe this push, which is, it's, you know, to use a football term, this is a Hail Mary. Like what we saw last night was a Hail Mary and the ball is in the air. The only thing is, does it get completed or does it get batted down and then the season shut down? I do think there is a massive movement that is taking place where, you know, hey, the player's voice might actually matter and be heard where you start to, and this is the loophole that I think the players are really pushing for, which makes a ton of sense. And it's something that Barton's brought up. I know it's something that I brought up, is that the safest place for college players, football players, might actually be on the team. And I don't think that's something that a lot of people, I think the assumption was, and it might be a correct assumption, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, the assumption has been, oh, they're in danger if they're playing football because they're going to be in a confined space. They're going to be tackling and it's going to be dangerous. I think players are alerting the decision makers to say, I don't want to have to stay at home potentially if that's what their school is, not letting students on campus. I think they're saying, no. The safest place we can be if you truly care about our health and safety is actually on the team going through the protocols, having our temperature checked, if we do get a positive test, getting the best medical care. So I think that might be an angle that the players have taken that could actually influence some of the decision makers.
But if they decide to play, let's say that they do decide, say the Pac-12 and the Big 12 announce, and you know, Louisville coach Scott Satterfield was out here saying that as of this morning, ACC is going to continue to move forward. And based on my understanding, it's not, we are going to move forward and we are going to play all 11 games, because if we decide to start the season, then you know we are absolutely going to finish it. I think it is them declining to follow the lead with an immediate decision. If you decide to move forward, the virus isn't gone. If you decide to move forward, it's not like you could find yourself in a position like the Big Ten was at a couple weeks ago where five schools all had their football programs in quarantine. Like, there are so many pitfalls ahead. I know this feels like it is a major fork in the road, but to me, the Big Ten and the Pac-12, it sure seems like they're going to act first, but that doesn't guarantee that we're going to have full or complete seasons from the ACC, the SEC, or the Big 12, or that they might decide to make those same decisions on their own based on the way that things happen to go as they decide to work their way towards a football season. The conferences are acting selfishly. And so I do think that the ACC and the SEC sure seem to be trending towards, we're going to give this a shot. And I'm willing to give, if like the, did you see the Wake Forest University president speaking to the team this morning? And, you know, the team said, look, you've given us all these rules. We've followed all your rules. We are taking this seriously. We are trying our best. I'm willing to give the medical advisors who are speaking to these conferences and these university presidents, I'm willing to give them a shot to put in place the protocols. But, you know, we've seen from some of these strict protocols, if all of a sudden you start seeing massive outbreaks or quarantines, then it's going to be a decision that becomes easier than it is here in August 10th, when we're only getting started with fall camp, to be able to cancel the season. So Like I tend to think that the ACC and the SEC are going to continue moving forward, but I don't think that guarantees at all that they're not going to end up in the position where the Big Ten's at now when presented with more information or some kind of change in the medical situation once they start hitting and popping pads.
I take exception to something that Danny mentioned earlier, and Barton's mentioned it too. The idea of the players are safer if they're at school. And I understand what you're saying and why you're saying it, but I don't know that I truly agree that they're safer. I think that we're confusing safety with medical access. I think that if they're on campus and they're in the bubble, they're getting tested more often. But getting tested doesn't keep you safe from COVID. It just tells you if you have COVID. And then once you have it, okay, you've got access to treatment. And that's a good thing. So I get what you're saying there, but I think we're confusing safety with just availability of healthcare. Once you get it, you get it. And there was a story in the Washington Post on Saturday. Now, I'm just going to read a part of it. About the effects, there's not enough data so far to confirm it, but the effects of what they're seeing from COVID, not just on people in general, but athletes in particular. I'll read. Infectious disease and cardiovascular experts do not have enough data to make conclusions about how COVID-19 might affect an athlete's heart, and even recent studies of other populations require further validations. But what they have seen has alarmed them. Quote, We have very strong, serious concerns about the potential for COVID to affect athletes cardiovascularly, said Michael Emery, the co-director of the sports cardiology department at the Cleveland Clinic. When you look at COVID in general, there seems to be a higher predilection for involvement with the heart than about any other virus we've seen. Emery said cardiological experts worldwide have published 5 or 6 significant papers regarding COVID-19 in athletes. Quote, all the papers agree that there should be a heightened level of concern with this virus and cardiac involvement in athletes, Emery said. While the specifics and suggestions of how to manage the risk differ in those papers, quote, the overall level of concern is greatly there. Dean Winslow, an infectious disease doctor at Stanford, said research has shown as many as 20% of people who recover from COVID show cardiac abnormalities.
Okay.
I disagree with them being safe just because they're on campus.
Right. Okay. But here's the point that I would make, because I agree with what you're saying. Like when I talk about they're in a better situation to be safe from COVID, yes, part of it is access to medical care, doctors, all that sort of things. But that's really not what I'm talking about. I'm actually more referring to the idea that they have. Players have a collective a purpose. They have shared ideology that they are trying to stay disciplined. They have protocols in place within the facility and outside the facility that they are participating and engaging in. They are regularly tested. They are forced to quarantine if they have contact with anyone that's been tested positive. There's all these protocols that are in place with the intent of keeping them safe, with the intent of keeping the spread contained. And if there's no season, then all of those guys go out into the general population.
Do they?
Where there is no.
Do they though? Yeah, they probably.
No, UConn. All right, so the UConn is going
to
say.
Let me
finish. Either way, either they go back to the student population or they go back home. Either way, regardless, you're still putting them in a situation in which they have less knowledge as to sort of their exposure to COVID and less opportunity to contain that exposure to COVID. And again, we can talk about whether they're on campus is safe or not. We can talk about whether they're off campus is safe or not. Either one, to me, is an environment where you are more likely to catch the virus.
Comments from your boy Ricky Ronnie with ODU canceling its season lead me to believe that even though the Monarchs aren't going to play in 2020, players are at that facility, and they're going to continue having the support services. They're going to continue to be monitored, and they're
Are they going to continue to be tested 3 times a week or 2 times a week? And are they going to continue to have the incentive to try to quarantine themselves, to try to be contained within their other teammates, to try to check each other and stay disciplined? Or are they just going to be regular students?
So again.
I do not want to present this as if it's an easy decision. I don't want to present this as if there is a right answer and a wrong answer. But I do believe, And I believe this strongly, that if the problem here is that if something were to happen on a campus, if something were to happen in a season, and the president or the AD that allowed that to happen, and God forbid someone were to die, or even if someone were to just, there would be a mass outbreak, then they have to shoulder that. It is on them. But my belief is that whatever happens, whatever the case count is in a season within those protocols, and Old Dominion, by the way, I'm not even including it. This is really, to me, a Power Five conversation, because the Power Fives are the programs with the resources to be able to instill these sort of protocols and act on them. But within it, whatever were to occur within a season, my theory, my belief is that if there were not to be a season, that number would be higher. Those incidents would be higher. And the problem is there's no way to prove that. And so I understand the problem that confronts a decision maker, because, you know, it's all hypothetical. If something serious happens, they can't say, well, you know, you guys know if I'd sent them home, something worse would have happened. So I get how difficult that decision is to make, but I do believe, and look, based on what I know, I'm not a doctor, but based on what I know, what I've read, what I've heard, it strikes me as a very reasonable assumption to make that they are in a better position to live with the virus on campus within that program than on campus without that program or off campus without that program.
I hear you, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but this is a hypothetical. But we have situations right now that aren't hypothetical. You talk about the collective intent. Would you agree that Major League Baseball players have a collective intent to follow the rules? Because so far in Major League Baseball, a sport that includes people who are owned, you know, teams owned by billionaires and players who are making a minimum of 500 grand a year, who actually have more on the line than most of the players playing college football do. We have seen one team have numerous cases and miss another games. We've seen the St. Louis Cardinals, who've just had 13 games in a 60-game season postponed because they went out and they didn't follow the rules. They've had over 20% of their season canceled so far. We had a situation in Chicago this weekend where a pitcher for the Cleveland Indians, who is a Chicago native, was in town playing the White Sox. After the game on Saturday, did he go back to the hotel? No. He went out with his friends in Chicago. They sent him home back to Cleveland, made him drive in a rental car. These are professional athletes with a whole lot more on the line right now than most of these kids playing college football who are already making money. And we've already seen examples of they're not all willing to follow the rules. So how can we sit here and think that the players, these student athletes are all going to follow the rules? It's not a monolith.
First of all, I get it. And like I said, these aren't easy answers. But two points I would make is I don't think professional athletes have more on the line. The professional athletes, they got a season next year. They got a season the year after that. They're getting paid. These college athletes, this is like their only opportunity to engage in this. But I will also grant you that there would probably be breakouts. And frankly, they would probably be publicized and covered in a very ominous way. But and again, this gets back to the whole to the conundrum you're in here. But those breakouts would still occur, and in fact, they would occur in a much greater magnitude without these protocols and these disciplines in place. So again, I'm acknowledging it would happen to a degree, but unfortunately, no one is going to be able to stand on the table and say it would happen, but this is better than the alternative. And I understand that, but I also think that this is that's flawed in a lot of ways.
And I would agree with Barton, too, because I think whether baseball – let's say baseball had been canceled. Let's say they'd canceled the season with Major League Baseball.
Still might.
Those players – right. They're still good. But up to this point, like, you probably would have still had Marlins players going out, but it never would have been publicized. They never would have been tested because a lot of them were asymptomatic. Same thing with the Cardinals. So these cases would have still happened, but it wouldn't have got the coverage. I'll just, because this is the loophole that I think the players might have an angle with. And I think we can all agree there's nothing safe, right? There's no, and even the sport of football is not safe. It's inherently a dangerous sport that involves a large amount of risk. But I think the term safer then the alternative is what the players are shooting for. And I think it's the smartest way that they can possibly get this thing accomplished, or like we're all kind of acknowledging that we start a season, but who knows if we finish. So Darian Rencher, who was one of the players that was kind of, voice was heard last night, said, if you told me I could only get COVID playing football, then that's a no-brainer to not play, right? I mean, I think we could all agree with that. But then he said, but fact is that we can get COVID being anywhere, doing anything, and if we cancel the season, it's still going to be here afterwards. So I think that's the player saying we're aware of the risks, we're aware of the different situations that are available to us, either playing football going forward the season or not playing it, and they're saying we think it's safest for us to be, and that's in large part why Jim Harbaugh, put out his statistical evidence that said, hey, we've had all these players in here, we've been testing, they've been minimal, we think we can do this. I don't think college football can survive an outbreak the way that Major League Baseball has. That's why I don't think the season survives, because of the pushback that would come from the public, from media, from everybody, the criticism saying, I can't believe we're here. Although Clemson has survived to this point with, 43 players testing positive, and they're still practicing, and they've still been doing okay.
That Xavier Thomas story is concerning.
Absolutely. And he's out, and he's done for the year, and he's going to do that. And I think there will be players, and there should be players, that opt out, that say, you know what, it's not worth it to me. And maybe that's where I kind of hold out hope, but maybe it's too late in the game, where there's a policy, hey, if you test positive, you're not going to be allowed to return to play, period. Maybe that's the concession because of the heart risks that are available. I just think, and the liability thing, because I know that's a big point of contention with a lot of people that cover college football. How can you ask them to sign liability waivers? I've signed liability waivers for staying at hotels, for flying on airlines, for having my daughters playing golf tournaments, for going to restaurants. I sign them. I understand it.
Danny, no.
Danny!
Danny's internet didn't sign the liability waiver.
Is that it?
I think that's it for Danny.
That's it for Danny.
Danny.
You know what pisses me off, though? This is such, and Chip, get the dump button ready. This is such a shitty situation that we're in, and that we need to be here having this discussion in the first place. Because you know what I'm doing right now as we're recording this podcast? I'm watching sports. I'm watching a soccer match in Europe. There's no people in the stands, but it's one of many soccer matches I've been able to watch because, unlike us, countries in Europe didn't sit around and say we'll announce it tomorrow. Oh, wait, no, let's have a meeting. We'll figure it out tomorrow. They just did it right away once it started happening. And then a couple months later, they were able to have their sports back. There's no discussions about can we play this season. They're playing. They don't have fans, but there's a chance that with this next soccer season, they're going to be able to have fans too, because they didn't just sit there and pretend that it wasn't a big deal and we don't have to worry about it and maybe it'll just go away. They said, oh crap, we need to deal with this. And they dealt with it. And because they dealt with it, they're allowed to do it. But because we didn't deal with it, the four of us, or three right now, four when Danny gets back, we have to sit here and have this discussion about, well, what makes sense for them? Is this possible? Is it not? And it pisses me off, because I love this damn sport. I don't want to have a fall without college football. It's one of my favorite things in the world. It's part of my identity as a human being. And the fact that I have to sit here and weigh the risk reward factor of some 19-year-old kid possibly getting a disease that could affect him the rest of his life, along with what I want for my own entertainment, again, pisses me off.
It's become part of our To have your Monday, you're getting to talk smack with everybody about what happened over the weekend. To have Tuesday or Wednesday, you start to line up your calendar. On Thursday, you're dialing in your locks. On Friday night, you're just either in a group chat or out at dinner, just making a big declaration about what's going to happen for the biggest game. For the fan experience, college football has become a shared experience because the national, and it's a new one, national college football scene did not exist 40 years ago. It's a very, very new thing. And it's something that the Cover 3 listeners have loved. Like the people that tune in to hear about, the fact of it.
It's going to be windy in Laramie.
Like when you're tuning in for the wonders out in Laramie, when you're tuning in for like the Service Academy unders, like we know that our listeners are all over the country and all over the globe. Like it is a shared experience, and to have that shared experience taken sucks. I mean, it is just, we already feel lonely from being locked up and, you know, only eating food that we're cooking for ourselves for 6 months at a time. And to think that even something else that gives us a little bit of joy and a little bit of connection taken from us hurts. But man, I don't know. I can find myself, I'm allowing myself to be sad without trying to put any blame. I feel like there's been a lot of misguided blame cast across the board where I'm kind of sitting in a like, yeah, no, this sucks. This is very, very immensely disappointing. But if there is no college football this fall, I don't think that there's any, I'm not ready to specifically blame I'm not ready to start casting blame because I don't think that's helpful.
There's a lot of blame to go around, and a lot of that blame is getting put on people who shouldn't be blamed for it.
You know, it's funny is not funny, but like it's pretty remarkable because, you know, like there is a lot of like, oh, like reporters like wishing for the worst, you know, you guys are the ones that congratulations or whatever. And it is when you think back to when Kirk Herbstreit, like the face of college football, tweeted out whatever he said, or I guess it was an interview, like a TMZ interview or something, where he was like acknowledged some doubt about football in the fall, and that was like 5 months prior to the season or something, and he got eviscerated, absolutely eviscerated, and I don't think he's like tweeted since, as far as I know. And that's to me is a very clear, at least, and again, I'm not trying to cast blame either, Chip, but I think that's a pretty clear indicator of like, you know what, a lot of people probably needed to take this a little more seriously than they did. And a lot of people, you know, the necessity of pointing fingers either way was not very helpful. And just acknowledging what's coming is, you know, didn't have to be taboo.
Do you think if games are canceled, that all those support systems are going to be taken away from college football players? You think the games provide that structure so that they've got that shared ideology? Do you think they'll be like a lost in the woods? I'm just trying to understand it more.
Understand what?
Like the idea, like is it if games are canceled? Because I'm starting to like bring myself around to the idea of team activities taking place of, you know, I guess we can go ahead and, you know, start to get to the like Nebraska side of this. The idea that like if a conference makes an announcement that there could still be college football activities, unless a university president says like, we're shutting down the studio, we're shutting down everything.
Like, like Puffy on making the band.
Yeah. Like unless the university president or the college football coach shuts everything down, I absolutely see situation like you could punt on the 10 game conference only schedule that's been announced, but there could be scrimmages, like there could be games, there could be stuff that can be even on television. We could have nothing but bowl games. Like I'm just not I don't think that these dominoes are necessarily as damning as they are where it's if the Big Ten comes out, Commissioner Kevin Warren is like, we're canceling the all fall sports. I don't think that they put a padlock on the facility and then all of a sudden they're like everybody's out to fend for themselves. I think that there's still going to be a lot of support, team activities, and the positivity and the positive life experiences that you get. I think that can all still be there even with the absence of a certified Big Ten 2020 schedule.
Yeah, but I guess, sure. I don't even know if you're necessarily directing that at the discussion earlier, but my question is, like, if we're doing all these team activities, like, I guess you can just be socially distant and you're saying, all right, we're not having actual contact, and we're still going to test you multiple times a week. And so if that's the case, then okay, fine. Like, I guess I get it. We're going to continue to invest a lot of money in testing. We're going to continue to allow you to be around the program. You just have to do it in the same way you've been doing OTAs. So I guess that makes sense. But it feels like if there's significant spread on campuses, that's all going to come crashing down too. And so I don't really know.
Oh, if they send everybody home, that's what you're like. If you're spinning it forward to even like, if a university campus shuts down and everybody goes home.
What are the odds that if we cancel football, if football is canceled, how much longer until in-person classes are canceled this fall too? How much longer until schools say, oh, and by the way, students aren't coming back to campus? Because I feel like, and this could just be, you know, I have no evidence to support this. This is just a gut feeling where I feel like a lot of the idea of having students back on campus this fall was the same kind of, you know, fingers crossed kind of wishing and hoping that we've seen with football for the last few months, in which it was just, hopefully it'll just be fine by then and we can get back to normal. And now we're seeing football. We're not so sure things are going to get back to normal, but it was also, well, we can't have football if students aren't on campus. So now I'm feeling like if they cancel football, it's probably only going to be a matter of time before they cancel in-person classes as well. That has nothing to do with this. I'm just wondering.
And the irony is that if student, like, you know, the narrative is, the line is, if it's not safe enough for students to be on campus, then it shouldn't be, you know, it's not safe enough to play football. And the irony of that is it's actually safer. Like, if students aren't on campus, like, that should be even more of a reason why football should be played. But that circles back to the optics, you know, like the optics conversation, and it feels like optics are driving a lot of this.
Oh, you mean the sham of amateurism?
This thing has exposed a lot of fault lines in our society, and I think that just might be the latest one. Yes.
Okay. So, Ken, all right, are you going to take us into the We Are United stuff now?
Yeah, I was going to do that on the other side. All right. Okay. Coming up on the other side, how the players have gathered together in this pivotal moment for the sport. What will it mean for 2020 and moving forward? Next.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
We're right, united. Even me? Danny's back. Yeah.
Am I back? You guys can hear me?
Yes.
Jeez,
yes. We are united. Hashtag.
You guys might have gotten a 5-star review or two without me on there. All right. I think I figured this has been infuriating. Sorry about that. All right. I think I'm good to go.
You're in an internet dead spot in the house?
No, it's the same. It's this Mac Mini that they gave me. I don't know what was going on. I think I'm good now. Back on the MacBook Pro.
Mac Max, ready to go. So, all right, Barton, what's on your mind with the Players United?
There's so much. Okay, so a couple thoughts I have on the Players United stuff. I think it's Yeah, I think Tom, you made it. You talked about college football and college football players are not a monolith, and I think that's a apt comment. And I think it's to me that the Players United stuff is really interesting because it's a very powerful movement, and it's really awesome to see. Like it is, and I think it's meaningful, and I think it's important, and I think this could be the beginning of very significant change because these players are seizing it and understand their worth and their value and their power. That said, it's almost funny to me to think about, like, okay, Trevor Lawrence and 12 other guys get on a Zoom call and release a statement about, you know, what they want in college football, and we want to play, and it's a, we want to play as a hashtag. And I don't know who all has tweeted out, we want to play. I know I've seen a lot of Ohio State and Clemson guys tweet out, we want to play. Hadn't seen a lot of, like, I don't know, like Akron guys tweet out, we want to play. Right?
Well, it's, Akron, you know, ship sailed on that one.
but it's like, there's, you know, there was this discussion about, or like there's the 400 people that are Pac-12 United. And it just strikes me that there is no real way to determine what the real consensus is of college football players. And as I've been sort of fighting, I'm going to act like I'm on the front lines of this, but as I've been sort of advocating for the idea that it is safe to play or safer than the alternative, and that there can be a way to play, I also sort of acknowledge the idea that just because Trevor Lawrence tweets we want to play, and just because Ian Book tweets it and Justin Fields, that doesn't necessarily mean that the backup at Michigan State does. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that. And so there's this voice that's being projected that speaks for college football players, and I'm not necessarily fully confident that all college football players do want to play. I'm not fully confident that all college coaches want to coach. I think that, like, there's this is such a complex and nuanced issue. And I think that, and so I'm not even here coming up with like some profound statement or solution or anything other than just sort of an observation that as they've tried to seize their voice in this thing, it's interesting that, like, there's really no way to tell who that voice represents, really. And again, all that said, I still really am encouraged by it and encouraged by the movement and think it is important and significant. And I just don't know that that any of it. And we saw with the Pac-12, 50% of revenue, like, guys started tweeting out like the next day, like, well, I don't know about that. I kind of want to play ball this year. And so I think it speaks to the difficulty to mobilize and all the challenges that are going to be ahead.
I was a player rep for the Denver Broncos. So I was a player rep in the Players Association, the NFL. It's impossible to get only 1500, 1600 on the same mm-hmm. page, but that's what the voices are for, so that you can have those dialogues just as players and then hopefully come with a unified front to the bargaining table. But that's, see, this is where, and I took some heat, and I know I've taken a lot of heat on the comments anyway, but somebody said last night was really insensitive for me to say that the players were, that the money, that the 50% revenue was really what they wanted. And when I said they, I should have clarified, because there are powerful people, and there has been one in particular who has really spearheaded a lot of the Players Association. And it was no coincidence that it was in the Pac-12, because this was a former player at UCLA who has been really pushing hard, lobbying for basically the dismantlement of college football, to try to completely, you know, just upheave the college football landscape as we know it. And that's where I had a problem with last time. And I think that's another thing that came into play and was no surprise once Trevor Lawrence got on the call with some of the players from the Pac-12 who had this influence, that then they put out, because remember, the movement last night started as just tweets like, hey, we just want to play. And then good for them for coming up with the concerted, hey, these are what we want. And it was Also interesting that they dropped the 50% revenues. They dropped some of the other things, but there were things that are important that they needed to get out there. So I do think there it's not just the players. Like I think that's the point I want to make, is there are people who are influencing the players because they think they know what is best, and they're influencing them in towards that direction. And that concerns me. Now, I do have a question for Tom and Chip and Barton as well. I'll pose it to all of you guys, because I am anti pay the player. I'm pro name, image, and likeness. I'm pro getting bigger stipends. I'm pro better player experience. I'm better player medical and healthcare, but I do not want them to become employees. I do not want them to get paid as employees. So I guess that makes me anti-union, I guess. But on the flip side, I am 100% pro association, or whatever you want to call it, pro player movement, where their voices are heard. Is that possible, or am I contradicting myself by saying that?
I think anything is possible. I mean, I think, you know, there are some contradictions in what you're saying, but there's contradictions in so many parts of everything that we do, even with, you know, unions and hell, the government, politics. There's contradictions in every single thing we do. And so I think it's possible. It won't be easy. It won't be simple. And it would definitely take time. It's just like, you know, the players aren't going to be able to do it themselves. Like the person who is helping them along with this, or has been kind of driving it behind the scenes, they need somebody like that, because, I mean, let's be honest, kids these days aren't idiots, but these are still 18 to 22 year old kids for the most part who don't really have this kind of experience doing that kind of stuff. Like you said, you were a team rep, a player rep for the players union in the NFL. There aren't a lot of college kids right now playing college football who have that kind of labor and negotiation experience. So they're going to need advocates like that for them. It's just, I do think there is a way where you can unionize without directly paying the players. Like they can unionize to get the health insurance and all that kind of stuff that they want, and to increase their stipend. And we can do all that. And I think they could do all that, give them NIL rights, increase their stipends, get them health coverage, get them a bunch of other stuff, and probably do all that without saying, okay, and now we're going to add salaries to the mix. So maybe that's how they kind of skirt around it, where if there's no salary and it's just stipends, then they can keep the whole amateurism kind of angle where, no, they're not employees. They're just somebody we're taking care of. So I don't know. We do it all the time in all sorts of parts of our society with new laws and new things that we allow people to do and get away with, even if they're, you know, against another law or for this law, whatever. So I think there's a way to do it. I'm not smart enough to be the one to know how to do it, but I could definitely see something like that being possible, yes.
The current player representation at the NCAA level overwhelmingly does not include college football players, and is very small compared to what I think needs to be and what players deserve. And I do think that one or two spots on a 15 to 20 person across all divisions is not enough of a voice for the immense power imbalance that exists between college football and their universities. I do, from what I've tried to understand here in the last, 15 hours, you know, since all this has really been going, is that there is an opportunity for a players association that is a nonprofit organization that is not a union, where you are not going through a collective bargaining process, but you do have better representation. And maybe it is going to take these players right now to make being on some of those committees something that's more attractive, not something that, apologies to all soccer players, the nerd on the soccer player goes to do so that they can have a better job and a better resume down the line. Maybe it does become something that more people want to be involved with. But I think that the limited representation that does exist right now still leaves them as a very, very small voice, and especially in college football, a very small voice in a big room where they need to have a little bit more of a say. And it's so, so tough to imagine how that those player reps or that organization is even able to find a consensus across, you know, as you mentioned, all of FBS, Power Five, I don't know, but I do know that the way the system is set up right now, the decisions for their well-being are often being made without them having a say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just one quick. I do think it would be a lot easier or more likely to happen if the Power Five does break away from the NCAA and just kind of forms its own, you know, autonomous group. Because I think that if you do that, then you can have a centralized form of, you know, government or whatever you'd want to call it between those five, where they come up with, everybody has the same deals across conferences. Because I think right now, without that kind of, you know, group, it'd be really, really, really difficult. And that would probably be horrible news for the G5. And it would probably really affect the landscape for college football as far as that's concerned. But I do think if that's the direction we're going to go, and that's what we're going to see. And I have an idea. I mean, look at things that are currently legal in this country compared to what was legal in this country 20 years ago and thinking, oh, that'll never happen. I don't think it's crazy to think that this will be exactly what happens within the next 20 to 30 years, if it even takes that long. So, yeah.
I'm no labor law expert, but it strikes me as the leverage that a union has is, and you know, whatever we call this advocacy group for players, but the leverage that a group like that would have is the threat of refusing to play. And I think you can exercise that more with a little bit more peace of mind when there's no deadline on your eligibility if you're a professional athlete. And so it's hard for me to ever I'm hopeful that there's more of a voice from the players, and I'm hopeful that they are able to further lean into their power they have as student athletes. But I also sort of have skepticism that, like, how much are they ever going to be able to really press the decision makers, given that it's going to take some period, some unique year in which they do refuse to play, which is kind of what this season could be, is the year where, you know, the administrators want to play, but we're not going to play because we don't have the assurances that we need. But because any other year, you're sitting there and you're telling me that, like, oh, like, based on all the players before me or players that are going to come after me, I'm going to sit out and burn a year of my eligibility to pressure the decision makers into making the climate more beneficial to those guys that are going to come after me. And by the way, it's not just me that's going to do this. It's going to be everybody. Like, that's to me is like what's going to be hard to overcome in sort of the bargaining process.
There is a cynical part of me that's like, oh, man, I'm going to be so heartbroken if I find out 3 years from now that a large sentiment behind the scenes was like, okay, we just need to get these guys out of here. They're getting a little bit too friendly with each other. All these Zoom calls are making me a little bit uncomfortable. Let's just sort of punt on the season and we'll wait for a few new recruiting classes to come in. This will be old history by then. Like, if that is the cynical part of my mind, Barton has gone there, and I hope that that's not correct.
One question I have for you, Barton, it's kind of maybe a weird tangent, but based on what you said, like, let's say this season is canceled and it's done so with the agreement and idea that every single player this year will not lose a year of eligibility. They will still have it if they want to use it. How would that impact recruiting? Maybe it's not the biggest concern, I think, but that's just something that popped in my mind when you were talking about that. Yeah, what would that do for recruiting?
Well, I mean, it's definitely something that we've thought about, because it's something like you'd have to expand the roster, and you'd have to I don't think it would. Again, because the playing field would be sort of level and everyone would be working under the same structures and rules, I don't know how much it would change sort of who has the advantages or disadvantages. It would just – but I think you'd have to create some sort of delayed release of, like, bringing the roster back into balance. But, no, I think that's – you know, it seems like that – I don't know if they have the resources to add, you know, an additional 25 to 30 guys in the team on scholarship, and keep the guys that don't leave through attrition. But if there is no season, you know, that seems like something that'll be pushed.
And it should. I mean, I have a niece who plays tennis at Clemson. She was a senior her last year of eligibility, and her season was canceled right in the middle of it, and she didn't get to. So then Clemson Now they came up. Now this happened to a lot of spring athletes, you know, baseball players all across the country. Some schools said, we'll give you an extra year of eligibility when the NCAA granted it, said you can do that. Some schools said, thanks for coming, but we don't have enough space. We don't have the rosters. We don't have the money, whatever reason it was. So it's really, really complex. I think with the question that Tom is asking, because you would have to probably boost up the level of, it's not 85 scholarships anymore. Is it 105, or what does the number go to? And then it's this cascading waterfall, like this ripple effect that would not only impact next year, like it would take years to kind of get back on track, back to 85 scholarships. You know what I mean? Like it's just, it's a massive can of worms.
Yeah, I think that this is clearly something that is not just going to impact the 2020 season. This is going to be something that we're dealing with ramifications for whatever decision they make, whether it's to cancel the season entirely, to push it to the spring. We're going to be dealing with this for a while.
Okay, before we get out of here, how do we feel about spring football?
Can I ask you, Chip, can I go back one time? Because I think you opened up something that I did want to follow with you, because you said the cynic in you said, in 3 years, are we going to find – like what did change over the – because we were literally getting ready to discuss Big Ten win totals because the schedule was just released. The SEC, we're waiting with bated breath. We're getting all these schedules, and then in 3 or 4 days it went from, woohoo, here comes college football, to all of a sudden – we're almost stopped down. Like it's almost canceled. What changed in that 3 or 4 days? Was it the player movement? Was it the union threat, or was it a health scare?
It was the heart stuff. All of it was like the Indiana offensive lineman, as well as like the death of Florida State basketball player, Michael Ojo. Like there's been just like, and a little bit more information's come out on specifically the potential cardiac impacts even after you recover. I think that's made a lot of people nervous. And then I will say for the Big Ten, we started to get, even a week ago, we started to get reports that Commissioner Kevin Warren favored the spring. And I don't, so I think that at least on the Big Ten front, there has been some, a little bit less enthusiasm. Now they did rob us of our beloved, like, you know, hours of sleep with this 8:30 a.m. Eastern time tune into the Big Ten Network dramatic music schedule unveil. If you've been thinking about going in the spring for more than a week, thanks a lot for taking those hours from us. We'll never have that back. But I it's more the cynical part of me, and I think that the information about the potential cardiac complications, even after you have recovered, that is what the medical advisors have been telling the university presidents, and that is what's been making them more nervous about proceeding.
Yo, but they messed around, let Alabama hire a doctor as their strength coach, though. Did y'all see Matt Ray, PhD's tweet about that? One thing that really irritates me about One thing that really irritates me about COVID paranoia is the apparent thought that we know nothing about how the body responds to the virus. We do, and there's a lot of people smarter than me working in this area. Now, all of a sudden, myocarditis is an unknown possibility. I alluded to it in a paper I published in 2009 about sudden cardiac death among athletes. It happens after most infection, which we watch for warning signs all the time. Screening is very good. Nothing new here. I'm not giving any credence. I don't know if that's, you know, how much that should be trusted or not. I just think it's kind of borderline amusing.
Dr. Matt Ray, PhD, DD, SMD, has clearly already been ahead of all of this.
You got the good doctor down there in Tuscaloosa now getting those guys ready. That's a dangerous weapon there.
But, all right, so what do we think before we get out of here? What do we think about spring football?
Better than no football, right? I mean, that's...
As long as we get the Buffalo Bulls in the spring, I'll be happy.
If it's on, I'm going to watch it. But my concern with spring football is then what does that do to the fall season again? Because now we're looking at a situation where, you know, when you play in the fall, you're playing 12 to 14 to 15 games over a 4 month period. But now we would have a situation where, like, say they play in March and they play like a 10 game schedule, something limited, they get it in. So now you've got them playing between March and January of the next year. So over 9 months, you've got guys playing 24, 25 games. And what kind of impact will that have on their bodies? That's what concerns me. if it's, I hope that there's, but that said, me, I hope if they don't play this fall, I play this spring, and we'll figure out the rest later, I guess.
Give me the SEC and the ACC, and the Big 12 in the fall, Big 10 and Pac 12 in the spring.
Totally.
I'm looking at 8 months of locks, you know, 8 months of game previews. It throw in the Maction in the spring. I've sort of gotten myself to the point where if there is a spring season, I imagine we're not going to see any of the players who are going to the NFL. We will probably see more players, you know, opt out even for concerns of like what you said, Tom. And I don't even know if a 10-game schedule would be possible. I think you might even need to trim that way down. It might just be like the glorified spring scrimmages, which I would watch. And I would make picks on, you know, like even if it's only going to be you play your division or something for 6 games, you know, you practice during the week and play on Saturday, basically play the spring practice schedule. Maybe even the quarterbacks wear non-contact jerseys. Sure. But like would watch, would make picks for. And I wonder if even the fall season is going to end up about in that same position where we end up looking at this academic year and there's just not going to be a college football playoff. There's not going to be one national champion. It's just every individual institution playing as much college football as they feel comfortable playing.
Dusty Scott Frost quote.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like we're trying to play, you know, whatever. And then you got Ohio State coaches that are talking about playing in the SEC. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Like the Big Ten could say we're canceling the schedule, and then Nebraska's like, all right, cool, home and home with Ohio State. Let's go. I think that's a very real possibility.
Saban 20 minutes ago to Chris Lowe from ESPN, we shouldn't be having school. That's the argument. Why is it we shouldn't be playing football? Why has that become the argument?
Fair point. Oof.
What I think it's got to be anything is on the table. That's why I think that's the way the schools are going to approach it. Some of them, you know, like when you hear Scott Frost say we're willing to play anyway, when you hear Brian Hartline, wide receivers coach at Ohio State, you know, tweeting, hey, we'll join the SEC, give us a call. Now those are probably pipe dreams, but like spring football to take, would you take 7-on-7 football?
Yeah.
You know, I would. No. Right. No. You wouldn't, Tom. You say, forget it. It's too much of a shell.
Take away my lineman? What the hell am I watching?
Fair point. But they are higher risk. So we're trying to take
it. So there was
Tom watches the trenches, Danny. Tom doesn't care about anything else going on out there.
There was the, you know, Ryan Day and Jim Harbaugh got into a little
tussle.
I don't know. Tussle, yeah. Verbal tussle on like a Big Ten coaches conference call. All right, so let's just say Big Ten haven't even officially canceled yet, but we're assuming it's going to. So let's assume Big Ten goes and cancels. And like, is there anything stopping just Ohio State and Big Ten players and coaches just showing up in a, you know, some park in, you know, Detroit or something? And just saying, let's roll.
That's like what your beloved Yale Bulldogs did during the 1918 Spanish flu. As college football was getting shut down across the country, Harvard and Yale announced that they would meet at an undisclosed place at a certain time and still continue their competition.
Hell yeah. Anytime, any place, anywhere.
I mean, they could Harvard do it as like a charity event. Like, remember when those were like the first golf thing? We had those charity matches. We could have a charity Ohio State Michigan game on a random Saturday, get everybody quarantined 2 weeks ahead of time. It's possible. I am not giving up. Even if conferences cancel the season at the conference level, I don't think that means that everything is coming crashing down. I don't think that means they're putting padlocks on the facilities. I still think that there could be some kind of competition or college football available in the fall.
Well, just what we need though is because I love college football because of the passion from the fans, and usually there's this unified front, like we all love college football, right? It's there. This is, and as we've seen, this pandemic has completely divided it. So divided all along a lot of lines, even, you know, fans that might have been for the same team or even fighting amongst each other. Well, thank goodness now we have the president weighed in, which won't throw any gasoline on this fire whatsoever. Now that he's quote tweeted Trevor Lawrence, then he followed it up with a play college football. This to me is the most depressing aspect of being in this business at this time, because I didn't get into this to talk politics and to try, because it will be pegged. Oh, you want college football? You must be far right. You don't want it. You're far left. And then it just completely continues the divide to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So just something to look forward to this week with the president weighing in.
Danny, the president didn't tweet. He issued a statement, according to the email I got from the White House, which was just a screenshot of the tweet. It was President President Donald Trump issues statement on college football season. And it's literally, hi, Tom, blah, we think you'd like to see the statement issued by President Donald Trump. And it was a screenshot of the tweet.
Which tweet? The one on top of Trevor? Right? The retweet? Yeah. Or was it
the retweet?
The retweet?
Yeah.
It's funny. It's almost like, so he gave the Trevor Lawrence retweet, and he must have gotten like some good, like the base must have been happy about that one. Because then like 20 minutes later, he comes back just with like an all caps, like college football. Here's how everybody else did.
Let's take a vote. Do you think he read the whole graphic in Trevor's tweet? Like the part at the bottom where he says that the players want to unionize. Do you think the president saw that part before retweeting it?
Definitely not. He just saw that those flowing locks and remembered handing out hamburgers to all the Clemson's football team.
I remember that kid. He was a good-looking kid. Yeah. I'm going to tweet him. I want him to play. He's a nice guy.
He's a beautiful boy.
Wait till Trevor Lawrence is in the box at the State of the Union address. Like, that's going to be the next move. Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
What a mess.
I mean, anything else? Do we feel like our grievances have been aired? I did want to remind, more than half of America is not on Twitter. So what we see, the fighting on Twitter, isn't the fighting that exists in the vitriol that exists in everybody's heart. So that's maybe a good reminder that I tell myself and that I think we could all share.
Well, I got a question for you guys, because I'm clinging on. I've only been on the show a handful of times. I cling to the hope that I have, what little hope there is. What about Greg Sankey's comments? Because he did weigh in after all. And I think it's interesting, because I do think I have appreciated the way that the SEC has handled this, I think, better than any other conference. Being transparent, giving information, not having a lot of anonymous sources. They did have the recorded call, but even that call I thought was pretty informative and open, and gave the players a platform to share some of their concerns. But, you know, he has this thing out an hour ago before we're taping this podcast, says, hey, the best advice I've received, be patient, take time when making decisions. This is all new and you'll gain better information each day. Then he followed it up and said, the SEC has been deliberate at each step since March, slowed return to practice, delayed first game, developed testing protocols. We know concerns remain. We have never had a football season in a COVID-19 environment. Can we play? I don't know. We haven't stopped trying. We support, educate, and care student athletes every day, and we'll continue to do so every day. That to me says he's going to wait this out even longer and try to, because Florida, where I am, the tests are starting, you know, the cases are starting to come down. Deaths are starting to come down. Is there a hypothetical where cases actually improve? Because we've seen the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of this virus, where Sankey just holds in there, waits, holds the line, and then all of a sudden says, hey, we see an opportunity to play.
So I actually think in a way, like the Donald Trump tweet to me is not insignificant, because I, particularly given the Southeast is more of a red region, to me, like it gives a little bit of cover if people are looking for cover. And if decision makers are looking for cover, they might be able to find it in political support. And if, as you know, Ben Sasse, the senator from Nebraska, tweeted something, or a letter was, I guess, leaked that he sent to the presidents in the Big 12, I guess. I just think that there's a little bit more of a political groundswell, which I think points to, and again, all this is with the sort of caveat that, like, I don't think anyone knows what the right or wrong answer is. But if there's more support from on high, then it feels like there's just going to be a little bit more of a of an inclination to roll. I mean,
I don't know. I don't think you're wrong, but I think that at the end of the day, politicians are politicians, you know, right, left, independent, wherever you are. And if you look at, you know, the politicians mostly that have been tweeting and vocal about this so far, like, you know, you said the president, large part of his votership base is in the Southeast where college football is huge. We've seen like governors and senators from Georgia and Florida tweet, you know, let them play. We saw Jim Jordan, a congressman from Ohio, where college football obviously is huge, tweet, let them play. It's not a coincidence that the politicians who are tweeting, let them play, live in states where football's huge, because there's an election in November and you're scoring free brownie points. So I don't know what kind of impact that's actually going to have. I don't think it hurts. I don't think if you want to play, having the president saying, let them play, hurts your position, or at least with half the country. It doesn't hurt your position with one half the country. It hurts your position. So I don't know. I just, it's weird. I think that when you're a politician, you just look for anything you can do to score some points. And I think that's a lot of what we've seen on Twitter from them today.
I think that Sankey's statement powers my belief that the SEC is going to give it a go, that they're going to try, that they're just going to hold the course and they're going to try, and we'll see. I don't think that they will be influenced by any announcements that may be made this week. I think they're just going to continue to keep moving forward and see what happens. And I think that the ACC might be also on that same kind of plan, because John Swofford has rarely moved like very quickly. Like, right? It's always been very calculated. It's always been very plotting. So we'll see. I don't know. I think we're going to
I think there's two arguments to be made. Is one is, you should wait until there's as much information as possible. But on the other side of that, if you're standing on a train track and there's a train bearing down of you, how much time do you want to spend thinking about whether you should get off the tracks or not?
I mean, that depends the how you're looking at how much you enjoy the feeling of standing on those tracks. Those could be,
because at some point you won't be able to wait anymore. At some point you need to make a decision.
Yeah. I don't know. Wild stuff. All right. We will continue to monitor. We will continue to keep you abreast of everything we know, everything we're hearing, everything we're feeling. You can follow him on Twitter at Barton Simmons. You can follow him at Danny Cannell. You can follow him at Tom Fernelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.